state of Minnesota, and the site we're talking about today is the visited site of Minnesota, which is the St. Anthony Falls area. I was asked to give a quick timeline. I'm going to give a partial timeline, and then the superintendent is going to finish. On March 22nd of this year, I sat down with a meeting with representatives of Crown Hydro, and they informed me that they were considering introducing a bill at the legislature and also gave me a draft of a letter of intent and a draft resolution for the park board to consider related to constructing a hydro project adjacent to St. Anthony Falls. I brought that item to the full board the very next meeting, which was April 6th. The full board received it, and I referred it to the planning committee for the next meeting. The planning committee took that item up on April 20th and made a recommendation that I initiate a conversation about an agreement related to completing the Crown Hydro project. And that I used 2,000 cubic feet per second as a standard as part of that agreement. I met with Crown Hydro representatives 3 days later, Saturday morning on the 23rd, and went over a draft framework of what would be the minimum criteria that I thought would be acceptable to the board, realizing that the board had not taken a vote by that point yet. So I would also mention at the meeting on the 20th, the planning committee.
It's the first opportunity they've had to actually, oh, we have microphone.
Yes.
It's the first opportunity the planning committee actually had to hear and see the project. It hadn't heard or seen the project prior to that point. So I would say that Crown did a great job, and I think that everyone needs to know that the board, we asked questions for 3 hours. I think we finished at 11:30 at night. So we had a lot of questions, and I wanted to thank them for taking the time to come and speak with us and taking the time to answer all of our questions. At that point, after our meeting, I asked the superintendent to proceed with developing criteria and developing a draft letter of intent, and I'll ask her to finish this report for you.
Thank you, President Irwin. Thank you, Senators, for inviting us to come and give you an update on this project. One other element, the Planning Commission gave direction to the President of the Board and myself was to also give direction to Crown Hydro that they submit a proposal to myself and the President by the following Monday, which would have been April 25th. And that was confirmed also at President Irwin's meeting with Crown Hydro on Saturday, April 23rd, that they would submit a draft proposal. We received a partial term sheet from Crown Hydro on Tuesday, April 26th, they had indicated to us that by the end of business day on the 27th, we would receive a draft development and use agreement, and that by no later than Friday, April 29th, we would also receive a definitive schedule of payments and a detailed flow analysis. Even without the final materials that Crown Hydro was to provide to us, we began meeting with Crown Hydro on a daily basis starting on the 29th. And our decision was to both jointly with Crown Hydro and us was rather than formalize an agreement in a very brief period of time was actually to formalize a letter of intent that would lay out the elements of an agreement between the Park Board and Crown Hydro. And that's what we have been doing every day since the 29th. And we actually just finished a letter of intent that we sent out to the board at noon today. The board meeting is this afternoon at 4:30, where the board will be discussing this, a letter of intent and proposal. We are actually, I don't know if copies have been made yet, but I brought some copies with me of the materials that is actually going to the full board this afternoon for their consideration.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, members? Seeing none. Are there other tests? Senator Olson?
I think Mr. Erickson or whoever else will be representing Crown Hydro here.
Absolutely.
Thank you. I have to sign in, too.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Senator Olson, Senator Vanderveer, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Erickson. I am here representing in a sense, and in effect, Crown Hydro, but I am registered for an entity called St. Anthony Falls Power and Light Company, specifically representing an individual investor who would like to participate and see Crown Hydro happen. My colleagues, as you know, Quinn Cheney and Kerry Rood, have represented directly Crown Hydro. I am here certainly working with them and working with Crown Hydro. Council Tim Keene is here in the room, and I want to give a slightly different, a larger, higher-level perspective on this issue. This matter has been before the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board for 12 years, since the FERC, federal FERC license was first applied. And the question that I asked when I was approached by my client, because he thought this was a good idea, was, why has this not happened? And I think the appropriate answers are now going to be addressed. I want to thank the Park Board, for specifically President Irwin and Superintendent Miller, for the diligence with which the Park Board and its commission at their meeting that was described for 3 hours took again cognizance of this application and are moving forward. I think very much their mind and their attention has been focused by Senator Olson's bill, and we appreciate that. You may know that a bill that now is exactly in the form that it's been amended to is on the floor in the House. It would be my fervent hope that after that bill, whatever you do with it today, and I hope it can move forward because I can commit, and I think Senator Olson can commit, that there's a number of issues that yet need to be raised, and they will be dealt with. I know the room is full of lobbyists that have a number of concerns about relative elements of the bill, but I can commit to you on behalf of Crown Hydro, and I think I've talked to Senator Olson, that the bill will resolve those at the appropriate time. The point now is we appreciate the Park Board's consideration. We appreciate their diligence that they're spending time with tonight. Before and being passed out to you, I believe, is the letter of intent that is literally still drying, that was negotiated in long and detailed negotiations between Mr. Guerrero and Mr. Keene, representing Crown Hydro, and representatives of the Park Board and their council. So tonight will tell, I believe, and I hope, and I would certainly, we all pray that this letter of intent is approved by the Park Board tonight. It represents, I hope I don't overstate it, I'll let Ms. Miller speak for himself, but I believe it represents an agreement in at least principle, as detailed in here, between Crown Hydro and the Park Board staff. And I believe the Park Board staff is comfortable that they can recommend it to the full board. We hope the full board will adopt it. The process that's detailed in this amendment or in this letter of intent calls for two public hearings and a final vote on June 14th. That's entirely acceptable and appropriate to Crown Hydro. We think the progress that has been made in just these last, well, since March 22nd, as President Irwin indicated, has been enormous. We think there is no reason why this project shouldn't proceed. It is the stated policy of the state to use renewable resources. And I want to recognize that, I hope you recognize that if you got into the weeds of the letter of intent, that the principal objection that I think the Park Board has had for perhaps these many years was to preserve the aesthetic flow of water over what is the spillway, known as St. Anthony Falls, but it's a concrete spillway. And we have no intention, Crown Hydro has no intention of doing violence to that. When Mr. Keene and I met with President Irwin on 10 days ago, he made it very clear to us what the parameters that we would have to operate under to protect that asset. We have agreed in this letter of intent to protect that asset. And to my knowledge, that is the principal concern of the Park Board and the neighbors that live there. There are a number of other items that were raised appropriately by the staff in this letter of intent that I believe it's fair to say Crown Hydro has fully met. So I'm hoping that on June 14th, the Park Board and Crown Hydro can raise a glass of champagne and say this long process is over, that the policy of the state for renewable energy has been served, that the needs and wants and desires of the Minneapolis Park Board have been served, and the money that Crown Hydro has put on the table, as you will see in the letter of intent, is a great benefit to the Minneapolis Park Board and its citizens. I think, Mr. Chairman, that's the overall highest level view that I think that that you need to see. We, as I said, we appreciate being here. We appreciate very much Senator Olson's and Representative Beard's bringing this to your attention. We appreciate the support that the House, two House committees in three hearings gave the bill. But it would be our fervent hope that that bill does not need to become a law, and I don't think it will be, and I think that we can work this out with the Park Board. So, Mr. Chairman, with that said, I want to assure my friends in the room that represent a number of entities that have some specific concerns unrelated to Crown Hydro, that I'm sure that we can work those out if and when that becomes necessary, and I hope it would not be. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the push, and we hope tonight you see the next, or in the, you're reported in the morning that the Park Board has adopted this letter of intent. I see no reason why, given the fact that it meets exactly the terms and conditions set forth by Park Board staff and a number of Park Board commissioners in individual meetings, why we shouldn't have a unanimous vote for it. And that will start the process of full public hearings and a full definitive agreement. And you may never have to hear from us again. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Okay, thank you. Is there, Arlene Freed has requested to talk.
Can I just ask a question?
Watching.
One of the articles in the agreement is the historical and cultural resources. It's not very descriptive as to what's going on, but because the Crown Hydro is located in a historic district, what is the can you just give me an overview of what the intent is for the building itself and how that's going to fit into the neighborhood, or is that part of this agreement?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, I think you've seen, and I hope you have seen, materials that describe the physical presence of the Crown Hydro project. And I can tell you that the current plan, and this is not what was been on the table early in the 12-year history, is totally underground. That what we want from the Park Board is an easement and a license and a permit to open a hole, drop the turbines into the ground, cover it over, and it would not be visible or be seen. So I think we address that in that way. I think it's a better proposal than has been around for a long time, and I see no reason that that should be any implement any problem in being addressed. So I want to assure you that that's the case.
Yeah, Mr. Erickson, this looks like, you know, to those of us who believe we need a multitude of sources of clean, affordable power, this certainly looks like one way to do that. So.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
I know when I've, as I have been aware of the development of this project, it's, and as we've been, you know, the city has been concerned about, you know, green energy. And as transit has been added, I don't think there's too many people here that remember and rode the streetcar, but I did for several years in high school from one end of the city to the other. And after I was elected here, it changed to buses, I think, my senior year, but I had a chance to tour the old hydroelectric plant, which was on the other side of the river, that actually ran the streetcars. And in one of the upper rooms of that were all the, they still had all of the brass labels for the wires that went out to each of the different lines that went through the city. And so it's, I think some would think that this might be what can run the light rail or whatever, but it certainly contributes to the power grid for the area. And it's, I do believe that old plant if I'm not mistaken, it was washed away in high water one point, so it is no more. I don't know how much was retained of that piece of history, but I just wanted to throw that in for a little bit of local color, that hydroelectric power has played a very important role from this area for some time.
Thank you. Is Arlene Freed here? And would you, did you want to speak to the committee?
Yes, I
would you come up to the table, please? And could you state your name for the tape, please?
Arlene Freed. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today about Senate File 1191. I believe that this bill usurps the authority of the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board by attempting to compel the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board to transfer Park Board property to a private for-profit entity that has not been able to allay Park Board and public concerns about the project's economic validity and negative impacts on the historic St. Anthony Falls and adjacent historic and cultural resources. I have been attending Park Board meetings on a regular basis for over 7 years now. I have been present at the many meetings at which Crown Hydro has been on the agenda. It was a frequent topic. If this project was one of unquestionable and apparent merit, it would have been approved a long time ago. Unfortunately, it remains a controversial and risky project. The Crown Hydro folks are asking you to do what the MPRB commissioners, as stewards of our park system, have been unwilling to do. Please respect their decision-making authority. And I will comment that the devil is in the details, and I think that's really significant. I urge you to vote against this irresponsible and embarrassing bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, might I just make a comment? We are very cognizant of the fact that local input and control is important. But after 12 years, we respectfully submit that the state policy for renewable energy might well be something that you and this bill, in effect, mandates them to take a significant look at it. This legislature mandates implementing state policy in many ways. It's not unheard of. In fact, it's very regular. And I would just say to the committee again, and whether there are other people lined up to testify, I want to again assure those who are concerned that it reaches something other than Crown Hydro. We have been working with all of them, and will, Senator Olson will do so too, so that the bill in the end, if it has to pass, and I hope it doesn't, will not do any harm or violence to anything unintended. But I do want to say again, in response to Ms. Freed, that I think her argument is old news. What you have in front of you today, on May 4th, 2011, is the state of the art in terms of those negotiations. The concerns and questions that she raised are fully addressed. If she has confidence in the Park Board and its staff, she should let them vet that tonight in two public hearings and at a final meeting in March, in June, and we will be pleased with that outcome because I think we have a compelling case that meets state policy, that answers the Park Board's significant questions, puts $500,000 in the Park Board coffers along with significant amount every year, and we think it's good public policy, and we hope you'll support this bill as you choose to do. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'll be very brief because I know this bill is taking an unusual path and has some negotiations going on during it. Just need to point out that the amendment that was adopted today, the A2 amendment, has a couple of segments that mean that I need to point out the concern they raise in the event that this does go forward. This expands the scope of the bill to include all cities of the first class. That means Rochester is affected, Duluth is affected, St. Paul and Minneapolis. Duluth probably isn't in line for any dams in the near future, but Rochester, St. Paul, and Minneapolis already all have them. And one of the things that this does is removes all local rules, regulations, ordinances, land use controls, permissions, authorizations, licenses, and permits for anything, for any purpose, for any local regulation from applying to an owner of a dam. not just for the construction of a dam in a navigable waterway, but for any use of any kind on that property. So we are making it very clear that this is a very, very overreaching way to address this, and we would have very significant concerns if the bill were to move forward with this language at a future date. That's all I needed to say, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer any questions I can.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on that, then, Senator Olson, it seemed like, and I didn't review this carefully, but it seemed like the way your bill was originally intended or drafted, it only applied to this project in Minneapolis. So why the, could you just explain why the amendment to expand it so greatly?
Yeah. Senator Olson.
Mr. Erickson would like to respond to that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben. It is clear that the issue that Crown Hydro needed to address was the specific project that we're addressing in the original bill. As our friends at the Park Board pointed out, you know, if you pass a bill that's very specific, you run into constitutional limitations with regard to a being special legislation. So we obviously widened the net. And so that we would not have that that infirmity. The widened net has brought a number of our friends to the table. And I want to assure them again that it is not our intent to do that. I believe somewhere between the widest net and something that can be very effective with respect to the projected objective can be drafted and dealt with in the future. But we're kind of between a rock and a hard place in terms of describing it. I think everyone here knows the intent. The intent, and I think the intent has gotten us to where we are today. I trust the good faith of Mr. Irwin, President Irwin, and the Park Board to pass this letter of intent tonight and give us a chance to do so, and I hope you don't have to come back. How you deal with the bill today, whether you pass it or you lay it over or whether you send it to Rules Committee, I think the point is that there's a bill that could be passed, but it would be in a different form. And your question is very appropriate, Representative Senator Sieben. We'll have to figure out how we steer between those two poles. Thank you.
Further discussion?
I think President Irwin would like to respond as well.
Mr. Irwin.
Just a couple quick points. I think infirmary that he referred to is actually called the state constitution, which I think is something that should be respected, and I'm not sure we should be working around it the way this is attempting to do. This is a local control issue. I firmly believe that. And we have looked at this in depth repeatedly over and over and over again. This is not like we've looked at it only superficially. So I just want to make that clear to this body because we have looked at this in depth. The other issue I think that's very important is that the Park Board has been supportive of 86% of the FERC-approved water that's there being used for hydroelectric power generation. Our concern is what the 14% that's left that actually has resulted in what we believe is a significant amount of development. This state and the Park Board invested $33 million in this park area around St. Anthony Falls. It is a resounding success. It's now the 13th most visited site with over a million visitors. Development that's occurred exceeds $1.3 billion for that $33 million. So this is, we're very, very careful. The last point I want to make is that, yes, we just got this, but I'm sure all of you would be a little bit reticent about passing something that you just received. A number of commissioners may just receive it literally at 5 o'clock tonight, and they at least want to look at it. And we also have a public process where the public needs to see this and get it and respond to it as well. So I do have some concerns. I appreciate Mr. Erickson wanting to move it along very, very quickly. But we do have a process, and we need to enter into good agreements. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would respectfully request that you do lay this bill over, whether it's the outcome of tonight's discussion or whatever effect gives us some confidence. I know you have another meeting possibly before deadline, but right now I think that would be appropriate to lay it on the table, and I just do hope that that folks can continue having a good dialogue and that we can end up with a good conclusion.
Thank you, Senator. Then the bill is laid over. And the next bill we have is Senator Thompson. which would be 1079.
That's a problem.
Senator Limmer moves that Senate file 1079 be recommended to pass and placed on general orders.
No, St. Paul said.
Senator Thompson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today. Before we start going through the specifics of the legislation, I would like to make an oral author's amendment. And for those of you that now have the bill in front of you, if you look at line 1.22, I would like to have the, and I'm sorry, 1.21 and 1.22, I would like to have the final word sincere, and then the first two of 1.21 of the first two words in 1.22 stricken. So sincere mistake made would be stricken and replaced by the words mistake made in good faith. And then also later in line 1.22, after the word licensee, I would like to add or the licensee, period. So how that would end up reading, Mr. Chairman, let me start on line 119 and read the entire sentence. In lieu of the license suspension provisions of this subdivision or a similar local ordinance, the licensing authority may take any alternative authorized enforcement action that the authority deems fit if it determines that the violation was caused by a mistake made in good faith by an employee of the licensee or the licensee. So I would at this time move that oral author's amendment and ask, or I would ask a member of the committee to move that for me, please.
Senator Limmer moves the oral amendment, and Council could read that back to us. First of all, is there any discussion to that? Maybe we should. Seeing none. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I just had a question.
Senator Harrington.
Can you just, I'm trying to get my hands around I had a problem with the sincere mistake to begin with, but I'm not sure that good faith makes it much clearer for me. Can you explicate that a little bit for me? I'm trying to picture how, as a cop going in there to make take an enforcement action, or a licensed person, what are going to be the kind of the elements of a good faith mistake that will give them some guidance?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Harrington.
Senator Thompson.
The answer to that one, in terms of changing it from sincere mistake made to mistake made in good faith, is that for purposes of determining intent in law, the concept of good faith is kind of a legal standard that is pretty well understood and applied in many circumstances.
Can we not pay the bill?
And so yes, this really was a matter of just substituting language that is more typical of what you'd see written in law, which I'm sure you probably have come into contact with many times. And as far as the adding the other little phrase, or the licensee, was simply to point out if this is a good faith mistake made by an employee or the owner of the shop, this statute would apply.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Further discussion to the amendment? Would you care to read it again?
Sure. If you're amenable, I have a little bit of a switch around in the language to leave some of it the way it is. It reads the same, so I'll read it the way that I think it should be done. You can tell me if you disagree. How's that? Does that sound okay?
That would be fine.
Okay. On page 1, line 21, delete sincere. And on page 1, line 22, after made, insert in good faith. And on page 1, line 22, after licensee, insert or by the licensee.
Mr. Chairman, that looks fine.
It does it? Okay. We have the amendment. Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. Amendment's adopted. To your bill, Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. The purpose of this bill is simply to put some discretion into the hands of the local governing authority. As you may or may not know, for many convenience store owners, small shop owners that sell tobacco, their ability to sell that product is critical to the operation of their business. As currently constituted here in Minnesota, if in fact a violation is noted and an establishment is accused of selling tobacco to somebody underage, and that occurs three times within a two-year period, there is a penalty that applies, and we do provide in law for a review. However, the review does not allow for discretion of local officials to determine whether the mistake was made in good faith or whether, in fact, that this is a bad actor that was routinely selling to folks underage. So this piece of legislation is really quite simple. It simply allows the local governing authority to take various things into consideration and determine whether or not the establishment made a mistake in good faith, whether, and as you can see in the bill, they're supposed to consider things like whether or not the licensee has a company policy which prohibits the sale of tobacco to minors, whether they provide relevant employee training, and the like. So this is really just a matter of allowing local authorities to say, you know what, this was not intentional, this was not reckless, the establishment has a policy and procedures in place that with the intent to prevent illegal sale of tobacco products to minors, and they can then alter the penalty accordingly, exercising their discretion. Mr. Chairman, that really is about it, and I'm more than willing to take questions now, but if you'd prefer to hear first from testifiers, I have Mr. Kevin Toma, who is here to discuss the bill further.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape, please.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, my name is Kevin Toma. I represent about 800 small business owners in the state of Minnesota. That group includes mom-and-pop convenience store operators and the like. We feel that Senate File Number 1079 will allow local governments the opportunity to consider mistakes that are made by employees on an individual case-by-case event, real-time happening. And we would like your help in allowing the local control people. We trust them at the local level. We feel that they can make good decisions and they can make sound decisions for the people in their licensing area. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion, questions? Senator Kalish.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, this suspension doesn't take place until after they've already had two penalties, which makes me wonder how you can have good faith mistakes that many times or that it's not corrected by the owner and the policy strictly enforced by that owner. It's taking away the state or the local municipality's ability to say this is a habit, and three times makes it a habit. Realize they have options, but some of this is about the state's ability to say licenses to sell tobacco is a privilege in this state, not a right. And I'm a little concerned that we're taking a system that's been working fairly well, from what I understand. I heard some different testimony. Maybe you've got that, and the compliance rates around the state is very high for complying with the tobacco laws. And I think part of it is because of this ability to suspend licenses. So,
Mr. Chairman and Senator Kalish, a couple of things. Yes, we don't dispute that the compliance rates have gone up pretty dramatically since some provisions were put into the law. You're exactly right. In terms of how could this be happening, I think if you look at the makeup of a typical group of employees within the kind of establishment we're talking about, there tends to be a fair amount of turnover. Oftentimes, they're young people that, you know, could be a first job, might not be familiar with these kinds of issues, and so there is some concern that these things can happen inadvertently, and there is no restriction on the ability to assess the maximum penalty allowable by law, but rather there is simply the ability to look and say, is this an employer who is attempting to do things correctly, has the right policies and procedures in place, but has had employees that have not followed those policies and procedures, and we don't want to punish them as though they were engaging in intentional or reckless conduct. I think that was the two points you made. If I missed something.
Yes, to a point, but one of the, Mr. Chair, one of the concerns is that, you know, by the time you hit to the third violation, if the owner hasn't got a solid policy training in place for his new hires, he's the one that screwed up on this, not necessarily the employee. If that is not a strict policy and strictly enforced, one of the concerns is that, you know, it sounds like there's some problem people that are selling, or problem stores that are selling cigarettes to minors on a regular basis. And, you know, if they do it for a fourth or fifth time, they can still get out of it. One of my concerns is that gas station is the only store in town in some of these small towns in Minnesota. So there's a reason why you'd want to ignore the suspension for some of your community members if they can't buy tobacco in a fairly short distance from this town. So,
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Kielash, first off, there are some places that have pretty significant penalties, even for a first violation. For example, in Bayport, up to $500 or up to 60 days license suspension or revocation. Once again, and I know the other point you made that I didn't get to is the right or the privilege thing. Clearly, nobody's asserting that anyone has a right to sell tobacco. You have to get a license to do it. And this bill certainly wouldn't alter that. This is simply saying, and I guess, you know, I don't know if you've owned a business or what you do. We've not talked about that. But I tell you, sometimes a person can have what they believe to be pretty comprehensive and clear policies in place, and they don't get followed. I have no idea what percentage of the time this would even apply. What I do know is, especially in this day and age when we're trying to encourage business, we're trying to encourage commerce, to handicap a business or make a penalty unduly harsh because there's no flexibility when there has not been any negligence or intent or reckless conduct, it seems to me we should allow local authorities to make those decisions. As far as if a local authority would say, well, we got the one convenience store, we can't do this to them, I guess my answer to that would be we can never prevent against what would be public officials choosing not to do their job. But I suppose the argument I would make there is, even if the penalty is mandatory, if they chose not to enforce it for those kinds of reasons, they could.
Hey, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Thompson, how long is the license suspension? And it's only a suspension on selling tobacco products, right?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Nelson, yes, it is an issue of selling tobacco products. It doesn't shut them down for anything else. You're exactly right. And if you look at the statute, it talks about the statute itself lays out the minimum, I believe, in terms of the length of the penalty. But perhaps, Mr. Toma, can you comment on specifically how the law works in terms of the length of the suspension?
Senators, Mr. Chairman, the ordinances for the licensors are all over the board. You were given an example of Bayport. That's just one example. The suspensions and fines vary widely for each one of the individual licensors.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Nelson.
So the local units of government determine what the fines and suspension should be probably because they know what's necessary in their community. So it seems to me that this is would just be a little subjective. In other words, the local units of government determine what is needed, so they develop their ordinances based upon what their experience is, what their community's needs are in regards to keeping tobacco out of the hands of kids. And yet this seems to just say, well, so you have your ordinance, but we're going to give you a way out of the own ordinance that you determined locally. I just see that's kind of fraught with problems.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Nelson, some of these ordinances are, as we pointed out, more restrictive than the state law. The state statute that's in front of you also prescribes what is done on a first violation, second violation, third violation. The problem is that if you look starting at line 1.15, no suspension or penalty may take effect until the licensee has received notice of the violation and had a hearing before a person authorized, et cetera. I believe, and I could be wrong, that there was an intent for that provision to result in some sort of discretion that hasn't happened. It has been interpreted as all that hearing does is make a determination as to whether the violation occurred. So what we're trying to do is point out that that hearing can result in applying a lesser penalty if these certain criteria are met. So, yes, it does put discretion in place where there may be a hard and fast rule, much like we do with sentencing guidelines, where, you know, that kind of thing.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Chair. But don't they already have that discretion? I mean, these are local units of government that are making these ordinances. So if there's a need, I would assume they could change the ordinance. Instead of, I mean, this would almost allow a local unit of government to make a decision based upon a personal whim or a certain, I mean, it just seems like it kind of goes against judicial justice that we have these, I don't know, I guess I'm just not comfortable with why we need to do this.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, number one, I don't necessarily think it is a problem to put that kind of control within the purview of local authorities who are close to the situation and know the players involved. But number two, the statute specifically lays out the kinds of things that should be taken into consideration, and it's pretty clear from that list that the attempt is to distinguish the bad players from those who are trying to do the right thing. And that's what we're getting at here, and I happen to believe that that kind of discretion is reasonable.
Just one last follow-up.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last follow-up. Is there any thing that currently precludes local units of government from having this discretion?
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, I believe yes, because the statute specifically says shall, that if, in fact, these violations are found, that it must be suspended for not less than 7 days, if you look at line 113 and 114. And that, and despite the hearing provision in here, all that is accomplished from the hearing is to determine whether the violation has occurred. So, yeah, they're currently, I believe that local officials are seeing their hands as tied, that if they find the existence of a violation, they don't have that discretion. Is that my understanding correct on that?
Is this where local control means we control the locals? Senator Nelson.
Well, so this is all about whether or not a third violation should result in a 7-day suspension of selling tobacco, a license for selling tobacco products.
Well,
Senator Nelson, or Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, it's actually, I believe, a minimum of 7 days. It's all about trying to treat the intentionally bad players differently than those who are trying to comply with the law but are having a problem with an employee or more likely multiple employees that results in technical violations of the law that were not intentional.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Thompson, I understand your intent, but the the problem I have with the way the language is drafted is it seems to be taking out the floor. So there, even on the first, second, or second policy, a local unit of government could waive the right to have a fee, which kind of gets back to Senator Nelson's point that there could be varying degrees of how this is interpreted throughout the state. I mean, you're not just getting rid of the third penalty issue. You're getting rid of the penalty of $75, and then the second offense, the penalty of $200 as well.
Mr. Chairman,
if the local unit so desires to do that, I understand
Senator
that
Thompson.
Part of it.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sieben, if I'm reading this correctly, on line 119, it says, in lieu of the license suspension provisions. So I believe, and counsel, if I'm wrong, let me know, but I believe that this refers only to that license suspension provision. And remember, this doesn't stop them from pursuing the upper end, but I think that's what it's getting to is a license suspension.
Senator Sieben, did you have a follow-up?
I guess I'd like clarification from counsel because it seems like you need to have the first and second violation first to apply towards the third.
The way I read it is the same as Senator Thompson. It refers specifically to the suspension provisions. So the first and second offenses that have a monetary fine don't really fall under that. So those would all stay in place. It would just really be that suspension provision for the third violation.
Third, Mr. Chair, or
Senator Sieben.
To follow up, to it would be third or fourth or fifth offense? I mean, assuming that they continue, what happens then?
Ms. Dangle.
I would assume that it would be for the later offenses as well. The statute doesn't really say anything after a third violation, so I'm not quite sure how that's handled.
So, Senator Thompson, is your intent that if a business wants to continue to, or if a business continues to violate this repeatedly, it's up to local units of government's discretion what to do?
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Sieben. I guess I am attempting to address the specific statute in front of us. I don't know what the law reads right now in terms of repeated violations beyond, you know, 4, 5, 6 and whatever. But I guess if your question to me is if this were interpreted to read could discretion be exercised beyond the third violation? I guess I don't have a problem with that. I would certainly think at some point your argument that you're trying to do your best becomes less and less credible.
I understand that, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair, but I also understand that there should be some uniformity where if there are repeated offenses across repeated offenses by an individual location or tobacco seller, that there should be at some point, even if the local unit of government thinks they're a fine operator and can sell cigarettes to minors, for instance, but if they want to grant them this variance or waiver on not being able to sell for 24 months, there should be some uniformity across the state so that there's some guarantee to the public that you can't be a repeated offender and get off just because you're in tight with your local unit government.
Yeah, you know, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, I guess the best answer I can give you there is this statute doesn't, in the first instance, before I ever brought this bill, doesn't deal with that I can see, and I guess I can't comment on whatever other law there may or may not be out there with offenses beyond the scope of the statute. I'm certainly not trying to alter that, and the statute doesn't.
Further discussion? Okay. Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, I appreciate the clarification on the good faith mistake, but I still have, I guess, my other question, and I think it follows in line with some of the other earliers, is that it just seems like we're changing this for not a lot of activity. The numbers I've heard, there are about 5,000 licensed tobacco sellers in the state, and last year we had 21 suspensions and one revocation. It just seems like the numbers don't really seem like there's a great need for this. Can you speak to why you think this is this is really needed? Because I'm just struggling with, if there's that few violations, how many people is this really hurting at that point?
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Harrington, assuming those numbers to be true, I imagine that one would argue that it's not a monumental problem unless you are one of those retailers and it did damage to your business. Also, you know, I can't comment on any other impact there might be from this kind of provision hanging out there, and maybe, Mr. Tolme, you can. Or if not, you know, the violations are what they are. I still think for those folks, the law should allow for an exception for good faith operating.
Did that answer your question?
Not really, but it's as close as I'm going to get, I think so.
Okay. Any other people, anyone else want to testify for the bill? Okay, seeing none. Gene Wagum, are you here today?
I need an assistant to manage the materials here if I can.
Okay.
A couple of things. My name is Jeannie Wagum. I'm with the Association for Non-Smokers Minnesota. My group has been working on reducing the use of tobacco by minors really since the 1970s, and actually I was here when the law was passed that this bill is attempting to amend. So any comments regarding intent at that time I think I could address. There was no intent to give flexibility on that third violation. The intent of the legislature at that time was to set a minimum standard, a floor, not a ceiling, because it was determined it was in the state's interest to reduce tobacco sales to minors and the use of tobacco by minors. The legislature at that time said, this is an important problem, and we should have a statewide standard to address it. Back when we started working on this issue, vending machines were the norm. Those of us who can remember back that far will remember that they were often sitting in the entryway of places like bars and restaurants, so that there was absolutely no regulation of who got access to those machines. It was not uncommon back then for a child to take a note into a convenience store or a grocery store that says, please sell Johnny cigarettes, and signed Mom. And it always helped if that was on lined paper. It was routine to sell to tobacco to kids at that time. We started doing compliance checks back then, and according to research done by the University of Minnesota, when we started looking at this information, 64% of tobacco license holders sold tobacco to 13 and 14-year-olds. It was an awful situation. What has happened since then is truly one of the greatest public health wins any of us can point to in our lifetime. Now, that's a dramatic statement, but it happens to be true. I'm sorry, I wanted the previous slide. I'm sorry. We're looking at tobacco use rates. In 1998, when this bill was originally enacted to law, 41.9% of high school students were smoking tobacco. In last year's study of tobacco use by high school students, it was down to 19.2%. This represents an enormous improvement in the health of our young people. Tobacco smoking is a pediatric disease. It is a disease that virtually only starts in childhood when the use of tobacco is illegal and the purchase of tobacco is illegal and the possession of tobacco is illegal. The only way we can hope to help adults be non-smokers and not have the health consequences of smoking is to prevent them from starting as children. So when we went to work in 1998 to pass this law, our goal was to reduce youth smoking. This chart shows what happened to vendors. We passed a law in 1998 that actually imposed consequences to vendors who sold tobacco to minors. And guess what happened? 64% of people no longer sold tobacco to minors. And in fact, last year, 4.1% of Minnesota's tobacco vendors sold tobacco to minors. Senator Harrington, you were right on. It's the baddest of the bad who are getting their license suspended. Your numbers were just a little bit off, though. We actually have 9,000 vendors, 9,000 people selling tobacco to minors, and 4.1% of those vendors sold tobacco to a minor during a compliance check in 2010. I would like you to guess, you've gotten the hint, how many of those 9,000 vendors had their license suspended, and how many of those vendors had their license revoked in 2010? Get that number in your mind and hold on to it for just a minute. I'd like you to look again at what our current state law actually says. The vendor penalties are on the first violation a $75 fine, on the second violation a $200 fine, on the third violation within 24 months, $250 plus a mandatory suspension of 7 days. I need to remind you that for a convenience store, an average size convenience store, according to their own information, sells approximately $20,000 worth of cigarettes per month. And yet we're slapping them with an incredible $75 fine. Obviously, it isn't getting their attention until they're looking at a license suspension. Now we've got that clerk that we've already heard, there's a lot of turnover, a lot of changeover, a lot of kids, a lot of minimum age workers are clerks. What happens to them? They get slugged. A $50 minimum administrative fee. And most cities, though not all, also choose to criminally charge that clerk, where they could face up to a $1,000 fine and 90 days in jail. First offense, that's the clerk. We're willing to smack that clerk, but we feel like we need to protect that business. Who knows why? This law also looked at not letting the kids off scot-free. When we worked on this law, we said everybody's responsible. The vendor's responsible, the clerk is responsible, and the kid is responsible. A youth that is attempting to purchase cigarettes is violating the law, and last year approximately 2,000 teenagers were charged in court and fined for attempting to purchase tobacco. Again, we're taking this all very seriously. And use of a false ID, sometimes you may have been led to believe that these poor vendors are getting their license suspended or whatever for a teenager using a false ID. That is an affirmative defense. If they sell tobacco to a minor and they relied on a false or modified ID in good faith, that is an affirmative defense. No suspension, no penalty, no fine. Now let's go back to what actually is happening out there. Whoops. One more. Last year, 2010, 15 statewide licenses were suspended out of 9,000 vendors, and one was revoked. When you and I were kids, we knew every place in town that would sell alcohol and tobacco to minors, and that was where the kids went. Senators, the 16 people here are the ones this bill attempts to protect. And they're the ones we all knew sold kids. And they're still doing it, and they're here today asking you to give them a break because it's just kind of an honest mistake. Why would you expect them to follow the law? Some people may believe that this is kind of a modern-day witch hunt, that somehow we just came up with this idea that we ought to sock it to the vendors. My name is Jeannie Weigum. My father's name was Emil Weigum. What you're looking here at here is a citation from April 1939, when my father was charged with selling tobacco to a minor, one George Dulkey. We were serious in 1939. We were serious in 1989. I hope you will remain serious today about keeping tobacco out of the hands of kids. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, there's a Pat Steig on the list. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you. My name is Pat Steig, and I live in Savage, Minnesota. Thank you for having me here. For the past 17 years, I have worked in tobacco prevention and control. And as a part of that work, I worked at a local public health department, and part of the work we did there was monitoring compliance rates in communities such as Farmington, Lakeville, Hastings, South St. Paul, and Savage, just to name a few. For the last 10 years, I have worked in monitoring those compliance rates, and as you've heard, the state law that was enacted many years ago has worked very well for our state. From my observations in doing this work, a key element of those local ordinances is the penalty provision. That includes a license suspension of a retailer's license after multiple violations. And there are just 4 points that I'd like to make related to that. First of all, thankfully, it is long ago that we've reached the point where we have multiple violations by the same retailer in Minnesota. Secondly, when a license is suspended, it immediately reduces the number of repeat violations as well as first-time violations in that community. Thirdly, if a retailer fails 3 compliance checks in 2 years, it is not the third time that they've sold tobacco to a minor. It is simply the third time they've been caught selling tobacco to a minor, just as if you were to find an automobile driver speeding 3 times in 2 years. It's not the third time that they've been speeding. Further, I have never seen a case of a retailer that has failed multiple compliance checks where it was due to a sincere mistake or a good faith effort, even though they'll always proclaim that that was the case. Rather, it is a clear pattern of poor behavior by that retailer and poor business practices. And lastly, as you just heard from the other testifier, a consequence of this pattern is that those minors learn very quickly where it is easy to buy tobacco. Suspension of their license is not only the right thing to do in the case of these retailers. In my experience, it is the only thing that changes that pattern of behavior. And as I speak with Minnesota parents about this matter, I have never heard a single one of them say, gee, I wish they wouldn't have suspended that license. Rather, it is, why did they take so long to pull their license? So in conclusion, the current state law, again, is working very well for us. It has for many, many years. I hope that you will vote in opposition to this bill. Not surprisingly, the adoption of the bill would be popular amongst tobacco retailers, but I can tell you it would not be popular amongst anyone else in Minnesota, particularly parents who are trying to keep their children off of tobacco. Thank you very much.
Katie English. Katie Engman, how about Mike Goldstein?
Sorry about that.
It's okay. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
Good morning. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Katie Engman. I am the North Suburban Tobacco Compliance Check Coordinator, and I have been coordinating tobacco compliance checks for the past 8 years. The North Suburban Tobacco Compliance Check Project is a collaboration of 11 Ramsey County cities, and we also collaborate with 3 other additional cities within Ramsey County. As part of the program, I coordinate all the tobacco compliance checks for the participating cities. I recruit and train student checkers. I work with law enforcement to make sure that they set up the checks correctly and follow proper procedures. I provide free vendor training to all vendors in our participating cities. and I also maintain statistics and do reporting. Our program is all about making it unlikely that youth will be able to walk into a store and purchase tobacco. We test compliance with the law, not what they know. We go out of our way to help vendors obey the law, but those few who do fail do face consequences. Over the years, the rate of noncompliance with the law has gone from 40% to 10%. That's over 90% of our vendors are passing these tobacco compliance checks. This says our program is working. But it would not work without our cities having the ability or the teeth to impose the needed penalties and be able to send the message that selling tobacco is a great responsibility, not something to be taken lightly. The second point I wish to make is our state has made it very easy for vendors to pass. It used to be that clerks had to do the math, and sometimes that was difficult with a long line of people waiting to check out and not always a strong skill trying to do the math under pressure. The Minnesota driver's license now is color-coded for under 21, and if that driver or that ID holder is under 18, it's clearly stated on there, 18 on. There's no need to do any more math anymore. I strongly support the continuing efforts of our cities to reduce tobacco use by minors and strongly support the existing penalty structure. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And we can stop our testimony. We can hold on the rest of the testimony. And vote. Any questions?
Seeing none, Mike Goldstein is
Chief Goldstein's there.
Not here today. Matt Schaefer. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Matt Schaefer with the American Cancer Society. I'm also speaking today on behalf of the American Heart Association, the American Lung Association, as well as Clearway, Minnesota. In addition to the other testifiers, we do want to express our concern, our opposition to Senate File 1079. A lot of the points we're going to make have been articulated by previous testifiers, and we really appreciate them taking the time to do that. The point we wanted to emphasize is right at this time, teenagers are smoking more than 800 million packs of cigarettes each year in our country. 14% of all 9th to 12th graders who smoke usually buy their cigarettes directly from a store. Others do that less frequently. We know that of sales to youth smokers, about 48.5% were not asked to show proof of identification. So clearly there's still a problem that we're trying to get at. In our view, Senate Files 1079 simply makes it a little easier to sell tobacco to minors, so we have some real concerns about that. One-third of all cancer deaths in Minnesota are tobacco-related. We're trying to cure cancer, so we do have a vested interest. I thank you for the opportunity to testify. Happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, I have no additional witnesses, and I would ask that the bill be laid on the table.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson, Mr. Senator Thompson. Your bill is laid on the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
Thank you. Senator Limmer, you have to.
I talked to Tom.
Next bill on today's agenda is Senate File 1009. Senator Limmer moves that 1009 be recommended to pass and placed on general orders. Senator Limmer.
We'll see how it goes. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the time. Senate File 1009 involves vacancies and nominations. This bill was sponsored by the Secretary of State's office. And I have Ms. Beth Fraser here to explain the bill. Before we begin, Mr. Chair, I have an A1 amendment as an author's amendment that I would like to move. And it's simply recognizing an effective date in the event that these provisions would be passed in light of some elections that actually do come up in off years. There are elections coming at the end of this year. And so this is recognizing a final enactment to be immediate in the event that the bill was signed into law.
Senator Limmer moves the A1 amendment. Discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Amendment's adopted. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. And Senator Limmer asked me to explain the nuts and bolts of the bill. This bill relates to vacancies and nomination, which is kind of an election geek's way of saying opening on the general election ballot, an unexpected opening. And for nonpartisan candidates, which is all that this bill deals with, there are two circumstances under which that could occur. One has to do with candidate filings, and this is what happened in the 10th Judicial District in the last election. If one or two candidates file for a nonpartisan office, then there's no need for a primary because we put two candidates' names on the general election ballot. So if at the end of the filing period there's only one or two candidates who file, they both move on to the general election ballot. If then during the filing period, either or both of those candidates withdraw, then there's an unexpected opening on the general election ballot. And what current law calls for is a new filing period in which nonpartisan candidates are required to file petitions, collect signatures, and there's no withdrawal period. And so in the 10th Judicial District in this past election, there were two candidates that filed for office, and actually both of them withdrew, and then there was this new filing period, and 25 candidates filed petitions to have their name put on the ballot. There then needs to be time to review the signatures and make sure that the signatories are from the proper precinct, and 24 of the candidates had the appropriate number of signatures. So in the 10th Judicial District, there are 24 candidates for judge on the general election ballot, which was problematic for election administrators in that it took up a lot of room on the general election ballot, but it was even more problematic for voters in that it's hard to learn about judicial candidates to begin with, never mind 24 candidates. And there were many voters who I think mistakenly thought that they could vote for more than one. If there's this many candidates, I must get to vote for two or three, like you often do in a park board race, for example. So what this bill does is it changes the process slightly. The problem is that with the current process where you need to allow time for candidates to collect signatures and you need to allow time to have the signatures examined, there's not enough time to place the names on the primary ballot, even if the law allowed for that, which it currently doesn't. There's a very short window between the end of candidate filing and the time when absentee ballots need to be prepared to be sent to military and overseas voters. So this changes the process and says that if this situation were to occur, instead of having a petition period, there would just be a regular candidate filing period in which candidates could pay a filing fee, or if they wanted to, they could collect petition signatures, but they'd have the option of filing the fee. There would be a regular withdrawal period, so if once all the candidates filed, they realized that somebody who they thought was a stronger candidate was running or somebody they didn't want to run against was running, they would have the option of withdrawing. And then there would still be time, if there were more than two candidates, to put their names on the primary ballot so that, like any other nonpartisan race, the field could be narrowed down to two. The other situation in which there can be, currently under law, a vacancy in nomination for a nonpartisan race is if a candidate dies after the primary. And what the current law requires is that in that case, similar to when Senator Wellstone died, you may remember that there was an extra ballot. It was basically photocopied and with the new candidates' names on it. The problem with that is twofold. One is that the laws have changed since 2002, and all ballots are now required to be accessible so that they can be read by accessible voting equipment. And if you just photocopy something onto a piece of paper, it can't be read by the machine. The other problem is that laws require that absentee ballots be sent to military and overseas voters 45 days before the election. And so it's impossible to comply with the law right now, one that requires that ballots be photocopied and another that requires that ballots be accessible and sent to military and overseas voters. So what this bill would suggest in that case is that if there were the death of a nonpartisan candidate after the primary, that the election goes on as usual. There's not a vacancy in nomination. And instead, either the other candidate wins, in which case they won, or if the candidate who died won, they will not take office, presumably, and then there's a vacancy in office. And there are other laws that dictate what you do if there's a vacancy in office. So that's what this bill does. It would be very helpful for election administrators, particularly local election administrators, in that it will kind of clear up some contradictory laws that are in place right now. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Limmer, do you have anything else you want to add?
No, I don't, but I'm getting a little nervous by the membership in the committee.
We still have four.
Yeah. Something now.
Yeah. Senator Limmer, this is a turn of events here.
You've been waiting for this moment for years.
Any amendments?
Members, do we have any questions for Senator Limmer or the Secretary of State's office? If not, Senator Limmer, do you want to renew your
yes,
motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 10-1009, as amended, be recommended to pass and go to the floor.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Passed. And 1009 is sent to the floor for general orders. And our
thank
next
you, members.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. Our next bill on today's agenda is Senate File 1340. Senator Peterson, good timing. Got it. It's a Senator Carlson bill. But Senator Peterson's been preordained to move it for us on the committee.
Gee, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move my bill, actually. This one.
Call me back.
Welcome, Senator Carlson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and congratulations.
Thank you. Brief promotion.
And your promotion.
Thank you. Senator Peterson moves Senate File 1340 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State Government, Innovations, and Veterans Affairs. Senator
Thank
Carlson,
you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1340 is called the Minnesota Accountable Government Innovation and Collaboration Act. We lovingly refer it to the MAGIC Act. Senate File 1340 will allow counties to establish pilot projects to provide a service by an alternative service delivery method that requires a waiver of or an exemption from a law, rule, or procedure. Before we get started, what I'd like to do, first of all, is thank our co-authors, Senator Higgins, Senator Senjum, Scoey, and Dames, for helping to co-sponsor this bill. And also, we need to offer the A2 amendment to get this bill into the shape that we need it in.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. While the A2 amendment is being passed out, do you want to briefly talk about it?
What I'll do, Mr. Chair, is have Mr. Joe Matthews from the Association of Minnesota Counties explain the A2 amendment.
Mr. Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties. This amendment reflects our discussions with a number of other groups that had some suggestions or concerns moving forward. The first section under the general welfare heading actually takes into account some suggested changes by the National Rifle Association to make sure that we are not preempting any state or federal statute. They were concerned that the way we originally had it drafted might be a little bit unclear, and so we've worked with their suggestions. And then the remainder of that section actually is brought to us by NAMI and other advocacy organizations who want to make sure that there's a chance for public input in the process we're going to outline briefly. The section 4 that's being added is actually language that was put in place in the 90s under the Carlson administration when there was some restructuring of state agencies, and we worked with AFSCME 5 and Council 5 and 65 to address some of their suggestions, and frankly, we think put into place some language that will allow us to work with our employees to move these processes forward. And with that, Mr. Chair, if there's questions, we're happy to answer those.
We'll have Senator Peterson move the A2 author's amendment. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Any follow-up questions on the A2 amendment? Senator Carlson, I'm going to continue on with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With us today is Mr. Tony Murphy, the county administrator from Beltrami County, and Ms. Lisa Weick, who is a Washington County commissioner. And so what we'd like to do, Mr. Chair and members, is start with Mr. Murphy, explain a little bit of the need for the bill, and then we'll move into having Mr. Matthews explain the fundamentals of the bill.
Sounds like a good plan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tony Murphy. I'm the Beltrami County Administrator. I'm here to speak in support of the bill. You're all aware that the traditional relationship between state government and county government is counties ultimately become largely the service or program delivery entity for state government and state programs. Under that program, much of what we do is quite prescriptive. And not only does the state tell us what needs to be accomplished, but oftentimes through statute and through rule, we are also told how we must do it. A colleague of mine described his experience with his young son to try to describe as an analogy how this relationship sometimes works. He described how he and his wife had bought one of those little red boxes or yellow boxes with all the shapes, and you're supposed to put all the right pegs through the right shaped hole. And as they tried to train their young child about putting the right peg through the right hole with the right shape, the child kept quickly learned what the real objective was there, and that was to get the blocks inside the box. So he kept opening the box and just throwing the blocks in. I think that's somewhat how we feel sometimes as counties. So we agree wholeheartedly with the intents of the state in what we should be doing. But sometimes we have ideas at the county level on some new hows to do things. And sometimes, quite frankly, we just like to be able to take the top off or rearrange some of the shapes in order to be a little bit more efficient, save a few dollars, and also to cut some of those onerous process steps or structural steps that kind of get in the way of efficiencies. And so what this bill attempts to do is to provide more flexibility in program and service delivery by allowing us to pursue some innovation, to produce some new ideas, which we believe right now with the economy that we've been facing and the issues that we've been facing at the state and local levels, ideas is the premium. That's what we should be pursuing. You have an opportunity, we have an opportunity to, through this bill, authorize 87 counties to be incubators of innovation, to have a process established to be able to pursue new ideas under pilot projects under state supervision, and consistent with guidelines that are shown in the bill, to be able to develop some new best practices, to establish some new ways to get those pegs or those blocks inside the box. We believe that there are counties who are poised to produce the commonly shared outcomes. This is a very outcome-driven process. We believe there are counties who will be able to be more accountable for some new ideas and some new approaches, and I think ultimately we'll be able to provide some efficiencies. Under the traditional approach, again, new ideas oftentimes had to be initiated at the state level and then be pushed through the system. What this bill helps us to be able to do is to flip that relationship just a little bit in a partnership with the state agencies and the state legislature to get more ideas coming from the county level through that system. And so, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I support this bill. I hope that this is something that we can attempt over the next couple of years, that we can learn from these experiences and hopefully be able to establish some new standards of performance through some new best practices that come from the county level. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Mr. Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just briefly explain how the bill functionally works. The first article is essentially transforming our counties from just an administrative arm of the state into a fully fledged local government, much in the same way your cities and towns have authority to act on behalf of their residents when there's a need within their community. Counties are different under current law in that we can only do things which you specifically outline for us in statute. And so there are a number of limits as to what we can do. The first section really just says that in areas where the state or federal government or other local governments haven't really carved out a niche, the county is free to move within that realm. And so it doesn't give us any preemption authority over anyone else, but it does allow us to step in and fill needs within our community as we see. The second article is really the heart of the bill. And what it does is it allows a county board to begin a process by resolution where they would create a business plan. They would actually work out the details, an alternative method of service delivery, and then provide that to the state. The state agencies that are impacted would have the ability to work with the county in collaboration, hence the collaboration of the title of the bill, to develop those outcomes and identify the performance measures that really are key. Where we see a great role for flexibility is that moving forward, the counties are given greater flexibility on the how we achieve the outcomes or performance measures that we've agreed upon with the state. In addition, as we go through, there's as a result of the A2 amendment, there is ample opportunity for the public to weigh in throughout the process, whether it's at the county board or it's at the state level in the agency comment period. And then finally, as we go through these pilot projects, they're allowed to extend for 12 to 36 months. We have a provision that requires a report back to the legislature. We're actually very excited to have our counties, as they go down this process, have an opportunity to come back before this body and others and talk about what we're doing and whether it's yielding results or not. And we feel that's really a key part here, in that we're not asking for permission to go off on our own and ride off into the sunset, but instead to go out and innovate and then bring information back that we can hopefully be of use to you in your duties here as a legislature, and also hopefully of use to our fellow counties that may be watching what other counties around them are doing to create innovations and then move forward. We do have some safeguards in here. In the event that a county deviates from its business plan, the state's able to terminate the pilot project. And we also do require the county to have a backup plan in the event that the pilot project is not yielding the results they want. They, on the front end, need to identify a strategy in which they would revert back to the old service delivery model. So we do feel that this is something where we're really pushing the thought process to the front end. We want to make sure that county is going to this with both eyes wide open. And frankly, as Mr. Murphy already commented, this is something our counties are really excited about. And if there's questions on the specific process, I'd be happy to answer those. Otherwise, I know Commissioner White would also like to speak in support.
Okay. Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I am here to testify in support of Senate File 1340. My name is Lisa White. Last name is spelled W-E-I-K. I'm a Washington County Commissioner representing District 5, which is most of Woodbury. I was first elected to the county board 2.5 years ago, and since that time I've served on a few AMC committees, most recently the AMC Board of Directors and also the AMC focus groups that are recommending the unmistakable advantages to the public of adopting the Cooley Doctrine in Minnesota. In other words, Minnesota currently is under Dillon rule, and I frequently tell people that I support death to Dillon rule moving forward. This is an elegant system change that transitions to an outcomes-based system of program evaluation that allows counties flexibility to test service delivery ideas that will benefit our citizens. I'm happy to report that just this week, the Washington County Board of Commissioners unanimously passed a resolution of support for the Minnesota Accountable Government Innovation and Collaboration Act. I won't read the entire resolution to you, but I did want you to note the following fact. Surprisingly, Minnesota consistently places at or near the bottom of national measures that assess capacity for local government innovation. So in the future, too, looking forward, Minnesota counties also face significant demographic trends, such as the anticipated silver tsunami, that will require innovative approaches to program delivery to meet the growing plus the changing needs of our citizens. Our county's goals are better services at reduced costs. So to conclude, I also caution my fellow board members this week that because local government aid is an unreliable source of revenue for local governments, coupled by the fact that cost shifts to counties likely will continue while we all ride out the economic recovery, that if the MAGIC Act is not passed into law this year, our county board will likely have to come up with our own MAGIC Act to balance our budget while keeping property taxes affordable and delivering the safety net services to our citizens. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have in my packet a number of resolutions from counties in support of the MAGIC Act and from my district. And I had to weigh out the
it was a balancing act. Do I support my logging and paper printing industry and flood you with a lot of paper, or do we try to go a little bit green and suppress some of that? Suffice it to say that other counties in my district, and I suspect that many of you senators on this committee have been also been given some resolutions of support from your counties as well. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members, if there's any questions, we'll be available.
Any questions from members? Anyone in the audience, anyone else care to testify for or against Senate File 1340? Seeing none. Senator Peterson renews his motion that Senate File 1340 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The bill is recommended to pass and re-referred.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you. Next bill is File 1068. Senator Peterson moves that it doesn't look like we're waiting for the line. Okay. We're going to as Mr. Jacobson says, switch gears. Senator Squire's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
1368. Thank you. Senator McGuire moves that Senate File 1368 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I do have a delete everything amendment, Mr. Chair, if we could have that passed out. I believe, I hope it's the A2 amendment that you'll be handing out. And what this bill does, Mr. Chair, what this amendment does is it actually takes out the provisions that probably put us into judiciary, but I talked to Senator Limmer, and he wants to still look at it, but he might waive it onto the House onto the Senate floor if he doesn't need to see it. And we're thinking that he probably doesn't need to see it the way it is now with this amendment, but we're going to respect that he wants to double check that.
So Senator McGuire moves the A2 amendment. Discussion. Further discussion to the amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment's adopted. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What this bill does is this comes to us from the Secretary of State's office, and I will have Fraser. Oh, of course I know this. I will have Ms. Fraser explain the need for this, but basically this will improve the election system so that we have a recording system so that felons are recorded in the system so that they aren't they don't vote. Felons by law are not allowed to vote, so this helps us track them or indicate who's a felon so that they don't, when they go to vote, they'll be indicated such on the voting records. And I'm going to let Ms. Fraser explain the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Fraser. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. And this, we've worked on this legislation in collaboration with both the courts and the Department of Corrections. And the way that the system works right now is the courts send us information whenever somebody is convicted. And if the individual is currently registered to vote, the system works very well because they're in our system, we're able to match them up, and we flag their record so that if they come in to vote, they're asked a series of questions about their eligibility. The problem is that if they register a year later, for example, and they're still serving their sentence, they're not allowed to vote, but they're not flagged in our system. We have been receiving this data electronically from the courts for about a year now, and don't currently have the authority to reuse it. And so this basically just gives us the authority to reuse data they're already sending to us so that we can check before elections or ultimately on a regular basis, has anyone registered that needs to be flagged? Has anyone registered when they shouldn't have? And or has anyone completed their sentence and we missed removing the flag? So it's a pretty simple bill. It allows us to use data that we already have just to clean up the process and prevent a few more people from voting who shouldn't. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Fraser? Further discussion? Does anyone else wish to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. Senator McGuire renews her motion that Senate File 1368 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is re-referred.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. Is Daly here? Senator Daly? He's on his way. Senator Cruz is in conference committee. Senator Cruz. Okay. Senator Cruz moves that Senate File 1260 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State Government Innovation and Veterans. Senator Cruz, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Just a little bit of process work here before we do get started. I have an author's amendment that I would like to offer. If I could please move the A5 amendment.
Senator Cruz moves the A5 amendment, and so delete everything. Is this the first committee for this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it is.
So discussion to the A5 amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Amendment's adopted. Senator Cruz, your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Essentially, what we have before us here is Senate File 1260, kind of a mandate relief bill, if you will, for our counties and cities. This bill does have the support of the League of Minnesota Cities, the Association of Minnesota Counties, Minnesota Inter-County Association, and the Minnesota School Boards Association. I do have with me Keith Carlson, and I would invite him to kind of go through some of the details of each provision.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm with the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I apologize. Commissioner Joe Harris, a member of our board of directors, was going to be here but had to leave for another appointment. I'll just start out by going quickly through the bill. If I can just grab a copy. Thank you. Section 1 is a change in who can do audits of counties. Right now, under current law, the state auditor's office does that unless they have given permission to the counties to use a CPA for purposes of those audits. This sort of reverses that situation, so at the county, at its discretion, can elect to use a CPA rather than the state auditor deciding at his or her discretion to allow a CPA audit. Section 2 is basically a technical amendment that goes along with the repeal of the 279 sites in Section 6. Basically is just saying that instead of having to go through a separate process to identify the newspaper that's going to publish the delinquent tax list, that the county, if it does not want to, does not have to go through two separate processes to identify the publisher of all its other legal notices and then separately identify the publisher of its delinquent tax list notices that it publishes annually. Section 3 also goes along with a repealer of 340A-414. This is a report that right now is sent to the Department of Public Safety of the 3.2 malt beverage licensees in the community. For the off-sale, there's really nothing that the state does with it. For the on-sale, the only use for the state of it is if those particular licensees ask for a state permit or license to sell between 1 and 2 a.m. Then they have a list that, yeah, these people are already licensed back in the community. 331A11 in Section 4 is just, again, a technical amendment with regards to the publication statute that changes the citation to almost all the sections in that chapter to just saying sections under this chapter. Section 5 is a very minor change in publication responsibilities that I believe the industry is agreeable with. Right now, when the county board adopts county commissioner compensation and per diems, they're required to publish that twice, once in their normal legal or qualified paper, and then a second time in another paper. This eliminates the requirement for the second publication. Then the repealers, I'll go through. I've already mentioned the repealers, the 279-07 and 279-08. Again, it's just a change in process. It does not change the underlying requirement to publish the delinquent tax list in newspapers. The 340A.403 citation, again, is the report to the Department of Public Safety of the 3.2 malt beverage licensees. 382.265 is an archaic provision that I know of no utilization in recent memory, where a county official, if he or she feels that the county board hasn't given them a sufficient budget to hire sufficient clerical staff, they can make an appeal to the county board for additional money. And basically is a circular thing. Since the county board established the budget up front, they're not likely to entertain an appeal of their own budget. All the citations that start with 395 are repealing an archaic county seed and feed loan program that dates back to before the Depression, where the counties could make loans to farmers for seed and feed, and obviously hasn't been used for years and years. Finally, the repeal of 471-61-61 subdivision 5 is probably one of the more notable provisions of the bill. It eliminates what I refer to as the aggregate benefit law. Right now, under current statute, in order for any change in basically employee health insurance to occur, regardless of whether this is during the term of the contract or after that contract has expired, both the employer and the exclusive representative of the collective bargaining unit has to agree to those changes. So in practical terms, from our perspective as the employers, the unions have veto authority over any changes in employee health insurance. And the practical difficulty that that creates for us is usually our health insurance policies rarely run coterminous with our labor policies, our labor contracts, and we find ourselves 1 year into a 2 or 3 year contract where our insurer comes back to us and says, we got to increase your rates 20% unless you make a change in the deductible or the copay, or in the worst circumstances, we decide we can no longer afford to be with that particular carrier and want to switch to another insurer and change the network that provides the health care for our employees. If any one of our several unions vetoes that, we can't make the change and we're stuck in limbo. What it does not do, that I want to make eminently clear, is it does not eliminate the collective bargaining for employee benefits, including health insurance. It is the state's PELRA law explicitly requires us to meet and negotiate terms of employment, and that includes fringe benefits such as employee health insurance. If the union wants us to spell out who's the provider, what's the deductible, what's the copay, that can be negotiated at the bargaining table. This just restores balance to what exists currently. And I also want to make clear that if there are any current contractual terms that explicitly express any of those items, we cannot, as employers, abrogate them during the term of the contract. So this repeal of this provision would not change either the collective bargaining of or allow us to abrogate the terms of the contract with regards to health insurance. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Hey, Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, just to follow up on that last point, I thought you said that you can't renegotiate during the term of the contract the aggregate value of health insurance policy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, what the current law says is that any change in employee health insurance, regardless if we're talking about during the term of the contract or after that contract has expired, up to the point in which the employees could go on strike, we can't change that without the agreement of the union. And since we are dealing as employers with usually several unions, for example, Dakota County has 14 separate unions for its employees. If any one of those do not agree to that change, we can't make it. And that's the state of the law. So as I again said, from our perspective, it's current law gives the unions veto authority over any changes in health insurance whatsoever.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
Just to follow up on that, it seems like it's a little bit unfair to change the aggregate value of benefits for a set of employees during the term of a contract. From my perspective, that should be something that you'd have to negotiate during the collective bargaining process. But to unilaterally be able to change it during the term of a contract seems unfair, especially to families who could have the terms of their health insurance value or the services they're provided dramatically altered during the term of the contract.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'll respond by giving the specific example which Dakota County finds itself in right now. Dakota County has the highest employee health insurance cost among the seven counties in the metropolitan area. To do that, they have proposed doing what a number of employers have done, and they discussed this in their labor management committee and had the agreement of the representatives of the unions in their labor management committees on the subject. Basically, they went from traditional, which, you know, I'll frankly acknowledge is rapidly disappearing, where each visit was the subject of a $20 copay, and instead went to a plan where they would have a $750 deductible per person cost on that. In exchange for that, the premium that the employee paid for family health coverage, not the employer, but the employee, was reduced by $4,000. In addition, they capitalize a $750 HRA, or health reimbursement account. And finally, the insurance provided what's called three for free. The first three visits to the doctor were free. In my estimate, I actually participate in this program. We get our insurance through one of our members, pay the full cost, both employer. I was $750 ahead, not behind, but somehow under this aggregate valuation rule, there was a conclusion that the aggregate value was somehow diminished, and the union members themselves, even though it had been agreed to at the labor management committees, would not agree to make the changes. So basically, in the interim, then, the county continues, and the taxpayer, and frankly, the employees, get to pay substantially higher premiums. Again, on a family health policy, $4,000 more than what was proposed by the county and what is in effect for their unclassified plan. So it's not, as you characterize, a reduction in what the employee has to pay. It's a roadblock to any changes responding to increasing health care costs that are driven by factors that are totally outside of the county's control.
Senator Seaman.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, and I don't doubt your account of that in Dakota County's situation. I just think that on the surface, it's unfair to unilaterally allow a county or another unit of government to change the aggregate value of a health insurance contract during the term of a contract. And in some cases, it may make sense. And then under current law, it's my understanding that you can negotiate that, or you can discuss that with the local bargaining units, and I understand that the cost pressures that local units of government are under, but again, it's not fair to change, in my opinion, to change the contract when the employees are counting on that benefit during the course of that contract. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move on line 3.25 to delete and 471.61 subdivision 5.
Mr. Chairman, could I respond? And I believe Ms. Kushner from the League of Minnesota Cities. Again, I want to make it clear what the current thing is. From our perspective, it's stacked against us. The unions can say, if we don't want to negotiate, we don't have to.
But
we are more than willing to negotiate on this subject. Again, if they want to spell out the terms of the deductibles, the provider network, the copays in the contracts, they're free to do that at the negotiating table. But right now, they're able to say no, period, without agreeing to negotiate anything.
And Mr. Chair, my response to that would be that I understand that, but then you should be able to, the time to renegotiate that is when the contract term is up again, so that then it's, you're on a more level playing field. Right now, if the local unit government can unilaterally come in and change the aggregate value, you're disproportionately given much more power or much more ability to just change the terms that have already been bargained for.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Seaman, the problem with that is that it doesn't stop when the contract ends. Under other provisions of PELRA, the terms of our contract continues for, you know, literally months. I think most of you are familiar with the situation where Minneapolis the school district was without a contract for a year and a half. Under current state law, all the terms of the prior contract that had expired a year and a half ago stayed in place. So all the steps and lanes, all the health care provisions that was in that prior contract that had expired 18 months ago continued in place, and the unions basically had the upper hand on it because they did not during that period, not only during the term of the contract, but after the term of the contract had expired, to say no to any changes whatsoever. We're just asking that some balance be restored
and that we have equal footing at the negotiating table to deal with this.
Well, Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Senator Stephen, I appreciate your amendment. I appreciate your point. I would just humbly request if we could maybe move through all the testimony before we start entertaining some of these amendments, which I'm sure that we'll definitely take a look at those. Could we move through the testimony and kind of flesh out the full picture, pro and con, before we – I think that's the normal operating procedure of the committee, if I'm not mistaken.
Actually, we could look at amendments after the testimony, if that's all right. Senator Seaman.
Actually, I requested – we already did go through an overview of the bill, so I'd like to take a vote on this now.
We're going to do the amendments in a few minutes if that's after we're done with the testimony. That's all right.
Well, it's not all right with me. I just as soon do it now.
Mr. Chairman, with that being said, I do have one more testifier here on the pros.
Well, I think we have a motion. And what was the amendment again? Can you rephrase it?
I've re-added the and in here, if that's all right with you, Senator. On line 3.24, after the last semicolon, insert and. On line 3.25, delete the semicolon and 471.6161, subdivision 5, comma.
Okay. And so exactly what are we taking out? Because now we're just doing, is that just these repealers on 3.25?
We would just be taking out the reference to 471.6161 subdivision 5.
Okay. Do we have a cop? Do we know what that is?
That's the language that about the collective bargaining for the aggregate value of group insurance that Mr. Carlson had.
Is that in the bill here?
The language is not in the bill, no.
How do we get the language that we're deleting?
I've got one copy here.
Okay. Could we get copies for the members? We'll recess till we get those.